Okay, so I'm also talking about place cells, but I'm linking it into learning, and in particular to spatial learning. But before I start, I should point out that this was primarily the work of David Dupré, I was very lucky to have him in my lab, and he introduced probably sophisticated behavior in my lab, and this is the avenue we are continuing now. And David actually stayed in Oxford and kind of inherited my group. He took over my job in Oxford. So HM probably came up zillions of times. The reason I want to bring back HM because HM was not only known that he had deficit in acquiring episodic memory, but he had the spatial memory deficit as well. So, for example, he could not find his way he could not be trusted to find his way home alone, or could not even find a way in his flat to the bathroom. So spatial memory is important for the hippocampus. And of course, the other good reason for it to study spatial memory in the hippocampus is that there's good experimental paradigms for it. The classical one is the Morris-Water test that all of you know.
Can I ask you a question about HM?
Uh-huh.
Was it documented whether he had any navigational deficits? Whether he had any...
it's probably my
ignorance. Yeah. About his lack of episodic memory,
yeah.
And things like that.
I mean, I guess the only thing I know is this, that it did not know the way home, and even within its home, it could not find the way to the bathroom. So
okay.
He did not have a spatial sense in general. But I don't know any more details about it.
Yeah, I don't know if they actually studied HM per se, but certainly didn't work on other mechanical musics that have demonstrated some spatial deficits. And HM, they did test his spatial memory of, in childhood, and he did actually have some knowledge of spatial layouts beforehand, so some people think that.
Also, as far as I remember, he could draw the map of an apartment where he lived after the surgery for a long time. It was impaired, but not completely, so.
I think it shows that probably even to a certain respect, spatial memory could be eventually independent of the hippocampus, although it's like, it's a very controversial field.
That's right. I interpret all that as the
argument.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So anyways, and of course we know that there are place cells, so, and I guess the final skipping through the introduction, so there are place cells, and then we know that the hippocampus is important for memory, and different oscillations are associated with different stages of memory processing. You heard a lot about theta, which is good for memory encoding and also for recall. It's present, and then you also heard about reactivation, and I also talk about reactivation, although not so much in details, and then these 200-hertz sharp wave ripples are one substrate when reactivation takes place, so ripples are linked to consolidation. I guess I have a couple of introductory slides that I wanted to skip, but anyway, so there's one more. So we have been talking a lot about reactivation analysis in relation to sequences, but as Joe highlighted, most of my work when I did reactivation, it was reactivation after exploration of open field environments where you cannot really see prominent sequence reactivation, so you have to have a somewhat more simplistic approach to study reactivation. So this is just an illustration for it. So you can imagine that you have an exploration, a sleep, another exploration, another sleep, and then always there are different environments in between these sleep sessions. So essentially the maps are different here and here. So accordingly what we expect, actually I think indeed the red is missing. Yeah, so sorry, it seems that with
some lack of VGA sometimes.
Oh, okay. Oh, you are right. It could be. No. Well, anyways, we have to live with it. So you have to take my words on it. But so in any case, so the idea is that in one environment, for example, two place cells may fire near to each other, so they have overlapping place fields. And then these place cells are expected to fire action potentials together in the following sleep as well. But if you take, for example, the environment where the animal was before, then these two place cells are probably, because they are remapped, they are representing different environments, then probably the same place cells in this other environment are firing apart from each other. So in this case, during exploration, they don't fire action potentials together, and accordingly, in sleep, they wouldn't fire action potentials together as well. So you can do two simple things to analyze reactivation. The most common thing is that you measure how correlated the firing of cell pairs during exploration, and then you relate it to how correlated these cell pairs fire together in subsequent sleep as well. And so what you expect that if a cell pair has correlated firing during exploration, then they will have correlated firing in the subsequent sleep as well, or if the correlation was low in exploration, then in sleep this correlation is also low. And then if you take the sleep before them, this relationship will not stand. So it shows, this is like a proof that patterns are reorganized. But if you want to show directly that this is place cells that are reactivated, then you can actually, what you can do that during exploration, you can measure how similar the place fields of the two cells are that you compare, and then you relate it to their correlated firing during exploration, and this is what is shown in this scatter plot. So if cells have higher spatial place field similarity during exploration, then you expect that they have a more correlated firing during sleep than those cell pairs that don't have correlated firing. And then, so you can measure this, and then, so you essentially measure the correlation of these two measures, and then in the sleep after, this correlation coefficient is higher than in the sleep before. Probably I will have actually two figures when I use this in the rest of my talk, but this is like a generic approach how to quantify reactivation in open field environments. So the essence is that what you expect if during exploration two cells share similar place fields, then you expect that these cells will maintain fire action potentials together in subsequent sleep as well. Or if these cells had different the place fields were at different locations, then in sleep they will have low correlated fire.
Did this happen, this pre-sleep lack thereof of minimization, was it even in familiar environment, or this is all novel?
No, you mean these sort of things?
Yeah, that the pre-sleep you don't have much.
Oh, I see, yeah. No, actually that's interesting. Yeah, if you take familiar environment, then in the pre-sleep you have always more. But so basically if you have novel environment, then indeed this pre-sleep is very low, but there's still some residual correlation there. If you take a familiar environment, then normally the pre-sleep sleep will be somewhat higher, but normally in familiar environment, what happens that we have like experiments every day, so the animal experienced this familiar environment as well the day before. So one explanation for this could be that this could be a residual reactivation from the day before.
Maybe I want to understand clearly, when you say in familiar environment the pre-sleep reactivation is greater, than this much or is greater than post-sleep? Here what I'm asking is that it's much, the pre-sleep is much smaller than post-sleep.
No, it's always smaller. It's always the case.
Okay.
It's just what I mean that this is not zero, and then so okay. The post-sleep is always higher, but this value in pre-sleep, if you take a familiar environment, then it's maybe twice as much than in a novel environment, usually.
And this is all CA1, right?
Yeah, this is all CA1.
CA3?
Yeah, actually I think it's pretty much very similar. So we had always some small data set in CA3, and in some cases in the past we also included this or separately analyzed it. And everything was very similar in CA3 as well. But of course, all these nuances about like remapping and whatever, how it happens in CA3, that we never went into.
Your analysis is restricted
to ripple episodes? Or? Yeah, traditionally it's restricted to ripple episodes, but if you do it in the entire sleep session, you get a similar results, only the correlation coefficients will be somewhat lower. So that's why we argue that actual ripples are better for this.
The use of pre-sleep is not consistent with what George talked about yesterday. Because even though it's enough sequence, but you would expect that it's the same location should be correlated.
Yeah. In my view, this one is somewhat different. So, or there could be another explanation as well, that there are some internal dynamics as well in networks that are not related to spatial firing, something constant in the network dynamics which will be present the sleep before and the sleep after as well. So the neuronal firing is not only influenced by place, but some internal dynamics as well that will be relatively constant across sleep sessions. But, yeah. Well, anyways, so the mainstream of my talk is really not reactivation. I will have a couple of figures about it, but it's really about spatial learning and what happens with place cells in spatial learning and how the network organizes itself. So during spatial learning. So I mentioned that there's a good behavior paradigm, which is the Morris water maze, but we all know that water and electricity does not match too well. So it would be, although some people have done it, but we kept away from trying to do the traditional Morris water maze task. So we use the Kästner maze, it's called the cheeseboard maze, which is like a circular arena, what you can hear, and then it has a lot of holes in it, and you can hide food in any of these holes. And so the advantage of this task is that, so you can put food in any of these locations, then this is a circular arena, so in between trials you can rotate the maze to prevent like odor cues to influence the animal, so you can rotate the arena in between trials. And of course, we actually also cover the entire arena with food dust. So the entire place smells like food. So odor really does not guide the animal to find the food. And you also see it because when we change the food location, the animal initially spend a lot of time to find the food. So what is the task? Okay, so actually, so this is our animal, so we use traditional 64 channels, although now we go a bit up. So this is our typical experimental prep. And so this is the the tasks. So in our case, we hide food in three different locations. And then the task of the animal is to collect the food in these three locations and then go back to the start box. Then we close the door, we put food again, and then the animal has to do the same thing all over again. One thing I should emphasize here, that we actually challenge the animal to a new learning situation every day. So essentially every day we find two different, we change the food locations. So every day the animal have to learn a new set of food locations. And so essentially the animal learns it. So this is the learning trial. Then we look at reactivation. So we have a rest session. And then after that we have a probe trial. And in analogy to the Morris water maze, in the probe trials we no longer give food. So we just check whether the animal is keep searching for food at the locations where it was before.
Are the reward locations visible during learning, or is it just trial and error?
Yeah, no, actually we have a control. I will show you later when essentially there's a guidepost that guides the animal where the food is, and actually it was a very handy control because then you show that place cells will don't care about the situation. So really, place cells will care about this when the animal has to learn.
The other experimental condition,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, of course, so this is inside the deep hole, so the animal would not be able to see where the food is. That's the design of the maze.
When you say place cells don't care about that situation, you mean there aren't place cells forming? You don't record
them? No, we have place cells, of course, but so anyways, I'm going a bit ahead, so essentially, in the normal learning situation, there will be a remapping of place cells, whereas if there's a guidepost showing the animal that the food is here or there, then there will be no remapping of place cells. That's all I'm saying, but I'm running a bit ahead of myself. Yes?
How many neurons can you record simultaneously?
It varies between 60 and 140, I would say. But yeah, I mean, it's only 64 channels what we use, but it's kind of, it's a good compromise that it's not too big head stage and it's still feasible. So anyway, so this is the probe trial. And then, so the reason we like this task because it imitates, or we can record simultaneously in all three stages of learning, so we can record that memory encoding when the animal has to learn the food locations, then the consolidation stage during sleep, and also at the record stage when the animal, we test whether the animal remembers these locations.
And then after you do this on one day, you have three locations in sleep, the next day he goes to the same...
No, the next day we select a new set of locations, so the animal has no clue.
So when do you measure recall? You say he sleeps. How long does he sleep, and then when do you measure recall?
No. So there's about 2-3 hours in between this and this.
It's on the same day?
Yeah, on the same day.
Okay.
But the practice is that we just want to record from the same cells.
Fine.
So if it's across days, then it would be hard to record from the same cells.
So do you see evidence for perseverance, so that at the beginning they go search from the location?
Yeah, no, actually this is what you see here. So actually what I did not tell you, that so before learning actually we have a pre-probe session as well that is normally used as a reference just to compare things, that as a baseline. So this is again a session when we don't give food, and you can see here that during these pre-probe sessions actually the animal tend to search for food at the locations where the food was the day before.
Do you see replay of that
pre-probe session? Actually we did not analyze this too much. Yeah. But so essentially you can see that this was the pre-probe, then you can see that in the first three trials the animal is more or less clueless, or at least in the first trial it's clueless where the food is, and then but after three trials, the animal knows exactly the food is, so it goes almost like in straight lines to food one, food two, food three, and goes back to the last location. Then you can see that in the post-probe, the animal keeps searching at the locations where the food was.
Okay.
before, so the animal did remember where the food was. Yeah, it's a bit annoying that we don't have red, but so anyways, so there was one more question, because how much long-term memory it is what we have, because we wait only for 2-3 hours in between learning and probe sessions, and is this enough to study like an entire memory, and can we talk about consolidation? So we had another trial condition, so another set of experiments when we actually blocked NMDA receptors. And so actually, in this case, we blocked NMDA receptors even before the start of the learning session. And so this is what you see on the bottom. And so actually what happened here, and this is kind of neat, that under NMDA blockade, the animal was still able to learn the new food locations, as you can see here. But if you waited like 2 or 3 hours, then the animal forgot it. So the animal no longer remembered these locations anymore. So at least this, the way we can justify that 2-3 hours is related to something like long-term memory, because at least we need NMDA-dependent plasticity to have a successful recall of these memories after 3 hours. In the normal conditions. Yes?
In the post-probe, the first location the animal looked, was that, did that show any evidence for them remembering the location? So overall there's nothing there, but if you actually look at what the first trajectories were, you might say that they actually went to the same places, but then didn't perseverate like a normal animal would. Did you look at that?
Yeah, no, I mean, that we did not look, but it would be a bit hard to look probably, because just statistically,
it's not the directional heading, or did they their first trajectory in what spots they went to? Because it would be a different
strategy.
Or a different interpretation. There's some evidence that they actually went there first and realized it wasn't there, and then did their separation on the
Well, at least what I can say later that. The electrophysiology would also predict that the animals will not remember this, because the place cells also don't remember these locations. So I think it's unlikely that the animals went there.
So is this a radical result? I mean, that when you, I mean, did you verify that these animals, like LTP, is blocked? I mean, wouldn't you expect there to be no LTP, for example, in CA1, CA3, and so on? And yet the animal's learning the task perfectly well. So what's going on? Why is, if you were to block LTP in the hippocampus, how are they learning a spatial task? As well as...
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's surprising that under NMDA blockade, the animal's still able to remember these locations for... Actually, the cutoff point was about an hour. So actually, one of our referees wanted us to check different time points, and if we took like half an hour, the animal still remembered. An hour, it was like 50-50, so some goal locations it remembered, other didn't. At 2 hours, it completely forgot.
But the way they solve that test, you might imagine you don't necessarily need a hippocampus or a spatial map to solve that. These could be doing a very stereotyped way.
So what's in
one might imagine,
and the odor
is that a temp dependent task overall?
I mean, it's similar to what Kestner did. He just did this with one goal location, and that was hippocampal dependent. Mm-hmm. So I would say that if we add more,
the same start location, because the way the animals solve the task here. I mean, this doesn't negate the physiology results.
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, sometimes we had the control, so we tried it with different start locations, and the animals also did it. It just, I think most of the time it was easier to do it with one.
How do you know the drug is working or not?
Because the animal does not remember. So we have a behavior effect.
Yeah, it's very surprising that he can learn without an NMDA receptor, but can't remember. It's as if NMDA receptors are, strictly speaking, involved in recall, not encoding. That's what this would suggest.
Well, that's consistent with Petros' stuff, with, right, with CPP injection.
No, yeah.
Place fields,
yeah.
Right?
That was motivating us, yeah.
It was remapping, so you couldn't recall, the map that was used to do the learning could not be recalled
yeah.
the next day.
And we get exactly the same result.
Sure. It just doesn't fit with, as Bartlett was saying, doesn't fit with NMDA receptors, LTP, and learning. It doesn't fit there.
Unless someone does.
The last 10 learning trials are done, it's in the presence of the food. The food is still there at these three locations, right? What you call the last 10 learning trials. The
yeah.
Is there. It's not
so actually, it's like in each trial, the food is there, and an animal collects it, and then you keep putting back the food.
So all through the learning trial.
Yeah.
So this last 10 trials, when you see the stereotypical behavior, is still in presence of the stimulus. It's only later when you evoke, try to evoke the memory, that the memory is not there.
I think he would argue that they have put food smell everywhere, so they're
yeah.
not going based on the food smell.
But there's rat smell along those tracks.
But that's why we can rotate the arena.
And you do that in the middle?
Yeah, every four trials.
How long is your user trialing?
I mean, how much we wait in between trials, or I don't know. I mean, probably like a minute. I mean, we have to put food again and do manipulations.
You would consider working memory.
Yes, no, I mean, of course. That's why we have the 2 hours delay, which is long-term memory. But interestingly, Ole, I'm with you in a second. Yeah, so that's actually true, that if we take working memory in the hippocampus, then you don't need NMDA receptors, but you need only probably you know which one, which GluR something you need.
So what I'm wondering is CPP present at the post-probe testing? Because it would be a very different condition for the hippocampus to have NMDA receptors brought or not. It could it be that actually TUS is not NMDA receptor dependent?
I think I expect that it's still in the post-probe the CPP is present. I mean, the dynamics is somewhat lower. I mean, obviously the...
Because CPP washes out quite quickly,
doesn't it? To be honest, even after 24 hours in our experience, we had to drastically reduce the dose if we wanted to repeat it again because... So all I can say that in some cases when we try to do the experiments 24 hours later and we gave the same dose, we completely anesthetized the animal. It showed that even over 24 hours the
you're suggesting that CPP is part of the context. Mm-hmm. So the thing called context dependent learning. Yeah, I mean it's a reasonable possibility.
Yeah, it could be, but as I said, it's with the place cells.
So when you say CPP, these animals are not learning, they've learned this task before.
They learn the task, but not with the current configuration of the place. So, yeah. So they learn the schema, I would say, but not the. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just confused because I remember experiments where when NMDA channels were blocked, like in visual cortex, the cortex was shut down. So I don't see how you can kind of get right in the middle where you block the NMDA channels enough that you would prevent learning-related things and yet not incapacitate the animal. So if the animal's not mm-hmm. blinded and deafened and everything else, and it's still functioning, then how do you? What makes you think you've blocked more than 50% of the NMDA current or something? That's kind of what
yeah. So actually, I cannot say that we had a full blockade. We had a blockade enough to prevent long-term memory and prevent also the stabilization of place cells.
Right, but so that is consistent with other physiology, mm-hmm. right? Because you can, if you don't give a very strong LTP-like stimulus, it'll be sort of a short-lived effect, mm-hmm. right? And that's sort of consistent with what you've got there.
Could be. What are those you use?
When they ask it, then it worked. We used exactly the same dose as Cliff Kentross. And if you ask me, since I did not do the experiments, I have no clue.
We can look it up.
Yeah, it's in the paper. Actually, I have been, people ask me this question several times, and I was never able to answer. Anyway, so let's move on, because I have a lot to cover. So what happened with place cells? So the neat thing was that first we looked at CA1, and then what we found that about 30% of the place cells changed their firing field, and they started to fire in one of the goal locations where the food was. For example, this cell fired here initially, and then this cell started to fire in this goal location, and then in the probe trial it still fired there. This cell did not fire at all before, and then it started to fire at another goal location, and then again in the post-probe it fired at the same location. We had also a cell that fired at the start box, and then this cell did not change at all, so it was always firing at the start box. So what was interesting, that so this effect we saw in CA1, but not in CA3. So actually in CA3 cells did not remap at all. So what was surprising in this task, that in CA1 there was a goal-related remapping, whereas in CA3 there was nothing at all. So CA3 cells did not remap at all. And this is the quantification. So you can see that, like if you take CA1, then about from the baseline 10%, the percentage of the cells that encoded a given goal location or goal locations altogether, it went up to about 25%, whereas in CA3 it did not change at all.
Question? Mm-hmm. So remapping, the top example, you're giving that as an example of a quote remap.
It's just
added a new little patch.
Right? Yeah, I know. This one is rarely it also happened that the other location came back, but probably this one was more typical, that the cells remapped to a new location.
By remapped, it just looks like a new place field emerged.
Yeah.
What do you mean by remapping?
Well, what I mean is that it moved its place field from one location to another.
Would it be equally valid to say this cell took on this place field? I mean, how do you know it moved it if you don't know where it was? I mean, it might have responses to a large number.
Okay, this one is the example. So if you take, for example, an NMDA, then you can see that this cell had a place field here. In this case, of course, it reverted back to the old one, but you can see that the place field moved to a completely new location after.
So is this similar or different than Marcus McNaughton experiment, where there was no task of memory, right? It would just walk on a different
path.
Is this
So for this is my answer to this. So we were also concerned that, or we were warned also before we did these experiments, that how do we know that whether this remapping is related to memory, or is it just related to the fact that the animal is not just randomly going about, but it started to do its task on a stereotypical way. So we had another task condition when we had this visual guidepost that marked the animal that the food is here. And then so essentially in this case, so I don't have the figure about the learning and whatever, but in this case, even in the first trial, the animal went straight where the food was, so it knew that it had to go there. And in this case, there was no remapping at all in CA1. So in this case, CA1 place cells always fired well.
But, I mean, it's nice, but it's at odds with the Marcus McNaughton result.
Yeah.
They got remapping without any task. It was pretty much like this. They just targeted four places and said remap.
But I think in their case, there wasn't a guidepost.
Yeah, but they're showing them with a hand. Mm-hmm. So they go here, and then they tap here. So, yeah. Not a guidepost, but they're showing them.
Your animal This was after they had been doing the other task? Or
it's varied. So sometimes they started with this. So actually we had to, initially it was after, but then in some animals, because we needed to expand this database, we had some animals when we mainly just did this task, and it was the same effect.
So, but, I mean, Marcus and McNaughton, they just looked at remapping and really quantified remapping as goal representation.
Yeah.
So this gathering for other kinds of remapping were goal.
But actually, in this case, really, we did not have remapping at all. So actually, I don't show in this talk, so we had the population vector analysis and place field similarity. So we quantified it all to show that whether there's remapping or not. I'm just keeping away. It's in the paper.
But they didn't get, so you do the same within the same session? So the...
It's a different day. So this was a different day.
So in unguided learning case, there is remapping. Can you classify them into like global remapping or
vector
remapping?
Well,
it's
global
remapping. It's so, global remapping. Yeah. Just,
do you have instances where the original place field is on a path, and then we have the
allocentric
case, it stays there?
You mean in this case?
Yeah.
Yes, so as you see, it's like, this is just the crudest quantification, because it just shows that, again, the proportion of our cells that had a place field or at or near a goal location, and then by chance it's about 10%,
okay,
and then it remains 10% during the entire trial. Yeah. So I go back to the NMDA case, because so what was neat about the NMDA case that it really reflected the behavior of the animals. So the animal was able to remember the task, so accordingly place cells also remapped to goal locations. But then when you took the probe session, when the animal did not remember, then these cells usually reverted back their place fields to the same place fields that was before learning. So these cells formed a new place field during learning, but similar to the cliff cantros, they did not remember these place fields in the post-probe.
I don't understand your representation. Like in the top row there, the last thing before the end called 8, you don't draw the whole arena. So you're saying the place field remapped, but we can't see the place where the original place field was. Is that on?
You can see that the flip row.
No, I realize that, but I'm saying, how do we know it, that last place, no, not there, but before, the one right to the left of that.
You mean here? Well, it's just the animal did not go there. I mean, it followed the stereotype.
So we don't know if it lost. I'm just worried about the word remap. I mean, something's changing. I'm just saying, it suggests that there's a reorganization suggesting the original place field disappeared and a new one appeared. But we can't tell from this whether that occurred.
Well, in this case, not. But I mean, in the normal case, in the post-probe, you could, because then in the post-probe, you can see what happens. But of course, in this case, because the map remap went back, we can't.
Remapping is just the general term we use
for
to encompass everything you're talking about.
It's anything that changed.
It's an alteration of the representation. Some cells pop up, some go away, some change their field, some change the firing rate. It's just kind of this global term that the representation changed, basically. But you're right. You can't tell, had the Amazon at that spot, we can't tell whether that still would have fired or not. Like,
that's
it. Did fire a new field at that location where it wasn't before. It's just this general remapping term is what we use.
Of course, the thing is, if in data like this, the thing comes back, you know, quote unquote, it sort of suggests it never really went away, you know, and so that's what I'm kind of wondering. If people say, oh, it's remapped, you know, it might have been some slightly sub-threshold thing that just popped back. I mean, you know, I'm just saying, remapping is a dramatic language.
Yeah. Well, I think it's still, to me, the important thing is that these cells fired at the goal locations, whether they had still a representation in the other place, so it's like a partial remapping or whatever. It's less of a relevant thing. It's more relevant that these place cells coded for the goal locations. I think that's the main thrust of the...
I'm just a bit confused about terminology. NMDA blockade prevent the stabilization? You mean when you had NMDA receptors, the place cells did not remap, or the remapper, what does it...
No, it's like the cliff cantros. So basically, during learning, there was a goal-oriented remapping.
Yes.
But in the post-probe, this new map wasn't stable. It went away. Yeah, it stabilized. It did not stabilize.
So with NMD receptor block, you still got change in place cells.
Yeah.
Not just change in behavior.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the next thing is what happened with the reactivation. So I showed you one type of analysis, but here we did a more of a population-based analysis. So we calculated something called the reactivation map. So essentially we took a shark wave, and then we took that, like the population vector of the cells that fired during the shark wave. So for each of our recorded cells, we get the instantaneous firing rate during shark waves. And then we compare this with the expected firing rate that you would get at any given location for different cells. So we had a vector, and then we compared it with the expected vector at location one, location, so all over in the circular arena. And then essentially we do a correlation, and then so what happened that at certain locations, what we found that this firing joint firing rate of the cells that fired during shark waves, that was very similar to the expected firing rate that we expect at one location, but not in others. And so this is what we call a population reactivation map. So it's essentially the vector similarities at different locations. And then normally we saw a hotspot. And so what was surprising that this hotspot was always corresponded with one of the goal locations that then we learned. Is it clear? And then the really neat thing here was that, so basically because most of the time one of the goal location was reactivated that the animal learned, then we could just count during sleep how often one goal location was reactivated, and then this was normalized. So essentially we measured what proportion of the shark waves corresponded with any given goal location. And then we also lumped together all of our recordings. And then the neat thing was that basically this reactivation index, or the frequency that a given goal location reactivated, it predicted the future memory performance of the animal. So it predicted how well the animal does in the future based on the sleep activity.
So this is very nice. And I wonder how much of that itself could arise due to the amount of learning itself. So for example, is it possible that the amount of reactivation itself dependent on how well the performance was during acquisition? And then you want to take out the amount of performance to say it was actually sharper reactivation, not the better learning itself.
Yeah, so at least I think the neat thing is that so we have three different locations. So essentially, the animal was like a machine during learning, so it went to location A, location B, location C. So I would say that during learning, the performance of the three goal locations was equal. Yet, after that, in the probe sessions, the animal still clearly spent more time in one of the goal locations than in the others. So they had a preference.
Was there any difference in the amount of time they spent in one of the three during it?
Yeah.
There was.
Yeah.
So in that sense, how much of this performance the next day or behavioral change the next day can be ascribed to sharper ripple reactivation versus just the behavior?
Yeah. So of course this is not the performance of the next day, it's the performance.
I keep thinking wrong, but post-sleep performance, how much of that can be ascribed unequivocally to sharper reactivation versus behavioral changes before that? Can one do something?
Yeah,
like
so for me, just behavior changes before that, there wasn't much because the animal did the learning as it was before. So whatever behavior changes were, at least we measured them after, because the animal was not doing the probe session before. Mm-hmm. And before that, the animal always had the task that it had to collect all three foods and then it ran in the stereotype tasks all this. So essentially it spent the same amount of time in all three locations.
Yeah, at some stage, mm-hmm. maybe nice to measure the learning before Saturday report, like a stroke trial before you went to sleep. Say, how well was that already?
Yeah.
To say, is it basically performed learning itself, or is it Saturday report? So much rides on it.
But of course, it's everything is circular because there will be sharp waves before as well.
That's
so.
True. But those are awake sharp waves. I don't think I'm going to get into
this. So again, I'm kind of humble. So I'm, of course, this is all correlations. Yeah. All I can say that, and I think it's kind of neat that if I take sleep, if I just record during sleep, I can predict how often the animal will go back to a location later. I think it's cool. The consequences were obviously it's correlations. It doesn't prove you that that sharp waves caused the animal to remember these locations, but it's a good indicator.
Would you ever have differential memory of one goal location versus another, and then they the one they remember?
Yeah.
Could you say maybe I didn't hear?
Yeah, no. It's that's why the analysis work that normally the animals spend different amount of time in the probe session in different locations. So it's like how much you call it memory, because the animal went back to all three locations, but it spent more time in one location over the other. Then I also wanted to touch what happened with the NMDA blockade. And of course it all comes up here that, so I'm taking these results with a pinch of salt because we probably did not have a full blockade. So we had a blockade enough that had behavior effect, but probably we may not block the NMDA receptors completely. But so the surprising finding was that under NMDA blockade, we still got reactivation. So this is more like, this measure is more like this co-firing based reactivation. And in this case, it's partial correlation. So we compensated for the sleep before and the sleep after. So in this case, the pre-probe is actually quite low because it's also obstructed. But so essentially, you can see that in the normal conditions, if you measure the reactivation of the goal cells, then they have a stronger reactivation tendency than the start box cells. Whereas under CPP, there's the surprising thing that there was still reactivation, but in this case, this enhanced reactivation of the goal cells compared to the start box cells wasn't there anymore. So the new learning location was not enhanced anymore. And then there was another observation. So essentially, we looked at basically, during learning in the beginning, you start with the old representation, and then towards the end, you get the new representation that is related to the goal locations. And then, essentially what you see that in the normal conditions, the firing patterns in the beginning of the learning, they are similar to the pre-sleep patterns, whereas they are not so similar to the post-sleep patterns, whereas the sleep patterns that were at the end of the learning, they are not present. Of course, it's all the subtractive partial correlations, but so they are not present in the pre-sleep, but they are present in the post-sleep. However, if you take the NMDA conditions, then you can see that in the post-sleep, so in the pre-sleep is, again, the beginning of the patterns are there in the pre-sleep. But the surprising finding is that in the post-sleep, both the beginning patterns that were the old patterns and also the new patterns are there. So it seems that there was a confusion in the reactivation, that both the old maps were reactivated and the new maps were reactivated. We could argue that could be one cause why the animals did not remember these locations later because there was an interference in the reactivation that there was a confusion in the maps that it reflected both the before learning or the initial learning conditions and the later conditions as well.
So this is something I hypothesized in 2007.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a... Mm-hmm.
We can talk about okay. it in discussion session. Mm-hmm. There's just one clarification. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by box? I lost the terminology.
Oh, the star box. Sorry. So the star box is... Okay, I'll show you one cell like this. So you see this cell fired at the start box. So this is the place where the animal always had to go back every session in between trials. And then these cells did not remap at all because this location, so it was a goal location in that sense that the animal always got food here, but this was not a new goal location because the animal did not have to relearn this place because this place was stable. Mm-hmm. So in many of our cases, it was a good control because there was reward there was place filled there, but the animal, it wasn't a new learning situation.
Mm-hmm. The box cell representation followed a neurotic history.
Yeah, I don't know. I would not expect so, yeah.
But the box rotated with the arena or box remained in the thick?
Oh, you mean when rotated the arena? Of course. No, but the box. No, you rotate the box remained at the same place. So you rotated the arena. But indeed, sometimes we did the test just to show that it's hippocampal dependent, that we moved the start box to different locations. But in this case, I think the start box cells would not. I think. So in any case, I just wanted to measure this because to me it was surprising that you block NMDA receptors and there was still reactivation. But of course the caveat is that we may not have a full blockade. So what happened with the waking shark waves? How are we with okay, probably the second half I have to speed up, but so what happened with waking shark waves? So we had also these waking shark waves at goal locations, so you can see there are some incidents of it. And then I want to refer back to this old study of ours when we showed that if you have shark waves that occurred very close to theta oscillations, I would say like less than 2 seconds before a theta oscillation, then there was always a residual place cell activity. So how do I show it? That, for example, if you take one place cell like this one, and then essentially you take conditions when a shark wave occurred outside the place field of the cell or inside of the place field of the cell. And then normally the way we quantify the firing response of these cells inside the shark wave is that we correlate the firing rate of this cell relative to the shark wave peak. And then there's always like a transient increase of the firing rate of the cell because of the shark wave firing, so there will be an increase of firing with those cells with shark waves. So essentially, if you take a shark wave that occurred outside the place field of the cell, then you see that's the baseline firing. There's not much firing of the cell before the shark wave because the cell was outside the place field, but then there was still a transient increase of this cell firing because of the shark wave. However, if you get the same cell inside the place field, then there was a baseline firing, so because the cell was firing inside the place field, but then there was a much stronger increase of this cell firing inside of the place field.
Well, it almost looks like you've multiplied the whole thing up. I mean, it's hard to tell whether there's a relatively larger response.
Yeah, so there was something like we call a supralinear increase. So this is the average response. And So basically, this one is the outfield firing of the cell, and this is the infield firing of the cell. And if you just shift this curve up, then this would be the extra increase of the firing rate of the cell, because it's from outside to inside of the rate of the cell, but this peak firing is stronger.
But if you'd multiplied it instead of shifting it, then it would have had a bigger peak.
Yeah, it's definitely more than just shifting it. So the firing rate increase of the cell during shock waves, in this case, was more than what you would expect from this extra addition of the spatial firing.
Yeah,
so I mean, I think it was like, obviously it's, yeah, so I think it's always like 0.2, I don't exactly remember how it was exactly, whether it's like 0.2 of the maximum, the 95 percentile firing rate of the cell or something like that. So it's always a bit of a pain to establish a precise place field of the cell.
People still have like a 400, 500 firing.
Yeah.
Can you say that this effect washes out in 2 seconds after?
Yeah, so in 2 seconds, basically, first of all, you would not see this difference, the inside-outside field, and also then, obviously, the peak effect would not be there. So essentially what happens, well, it's actually, to be honest, it's not 2 seconds, it's about 15 seconds. So if you generate this within 15 seconds, you still get this, and then it washes out.
15,
yeah. So it's a gradual thing, but up to 15 seconds it's there. And so the main thing is that if you take more than 15 seconds, then there will be a regular reactivation, which is, so any place can be reactivated. But within 15 seconds, whatever is reactivated will be influenced by the current location of the animal. So mainly patterns that are related to the current location of the animal will be reactivated. And so we apply this to our finding as well. So essentially, for example, we looked at goal cells, and then we took only those goal cells that had a place field in this goal location. And then, so this is the sharp wave firing of this cell when it was inside the place field, or in this case when it was outside, when we had a goal cell but the sharp wave was here. And then we also had a start box cell. And also, it's like also in and out, so the inside if the shark wave was here or if the shark wave was there. And so if we just compare the infield firing of these cells, then you can see that the goal cells had a much stronger firing, shark wave firing, than the start box cells. It was a little bit similar result what I have shown about reactivation as well, that goal cells had a stronger reactivation than start box cells. So in these waking shark waves, we had also a similar effect with the shark wave firing. And then another neat thing was that under the CPP condition, this enhanced firing of the start box cells was no longer present. The goal cells. So the goal cell firing was similar to the start box cell firing. Yes?
Was all the firing at the goal location during a shark wave ripple, or was there still fire at the goal location even outside of shark wave ripple events?
Yeah, they fired. So actually when we measured the place fields, then we excluded all shark waves, and we had a speed filter as well. So the normal place field did not reflect the shark wave ripple events. And I mean, you can even see it here that you can see that this is outside the shark wave ripple event, and then there's like a threefold increase of the.
And is that on beta? Yeah. Is that beta present at that time, or is it an LIA mode?
So these waking shark waves, normally the way I quantify them, that I take a theta segment, and then I say that here I still detect theta, and I still have a sharp wave. But I cannot guarantee that everywhere there's sharp wave there. So that's why I say that normally there's an interruption of the theta, but there's normally theta all around. And rarely, actually, you can even see ripples on the top of theta oscillations as well. Here I also want to point out another thing which is important, that in this case, if I just counted the number of these waking sharp waves, this theta, close to theta sharp waves at goal locations, then the number of the sharp waves also predicted the future memory performance. So with all this, what I try to argue is that you had David Foster, you had Lauren Frank, and they were all talking about planning and whatever. But I still try to argue that waking sharp waves have another role as well. They can have the initial stabilization of new spatial representations, and they should have a role in longer-term memory as well. And so actually what I did not emphasize with this sharp waves that just the fact that the spatial firing rate is maintained during these sharp waves, but there's a supralinear increasing of the firing rate, what you expect that this increased synchronization that you have during sharp waves, it can also promote plasticity and help this initial stabilization of maps. Okay, so this was the first part. And now comes the second part, which is about flickering during spatial learning. So it was both Mosers and Andre Fenton who showed that sometimes there's a rapid fluctuation of maps. So what can happen that if the animal is confused, that two different maps can rapidly fluctuate, and one map, both maps could be expressed along, for example, theta oscillatory cycles. So the original, for example, the Jacek paper showed that. So they had like an environment, and then I think they had some light, so they could very drastically change the environmental features by lighting up some walls, and then in normal conditions there was one set of map for the normal condition, and then there was another set of map for the lit up condition, and then what they observed that when this transition happened, then sometimes the two maps fluctuated. Sometimes one map was there, and sometimes the other was there. And I will explain it better with my task. So we saw also a similar effect here. So essentially what happened, so we know two maps. So from the pre-probe session, we know the map that was present in the beginning of the learning. So this is related to the map that the animal learned the day before. And then this is the post-probe session. So this is the new map related to the goal locations. So this is the new map. And then essentially, so we know the place fields of both maps. And then at any given time, we can probe which map was present. So essentially, you take all your cells at a given time, so you get the population vector of your place cells, and you know the location of the cells, and then essentially you can compare how much this population vector of the cell at a given goal location is. Is it similar to the map in the beginning of the learning, or is it more similar to the map in the end of the learning? And essentially, we had, we combined this measure. It's actually, we did like a correlation, like a z-test. And basically, we got a measure that it was positive if the population map vector at a given time in the theta cycle, it was more similar to the new map. Then, and if it was a negative value, then it was more similar to the old map that was present in the beginning of the learning. And then you can see that these numbers, of course, towards the end of learning, the new maps were dominating. And in the beginning, the old maps was there, but there was this transition times when both the old and the new maps were transiently there. And then I also have some expanded examples. So for example, if you take the first learning session, the first session when the animal did not know exactly when it started to learn where the food was, then the old map, most of the time the old map was expressed, but sometimes the new map is expressed. But if you take some like trial three, then both the old and the new map was there, even though the animal now know much better where the food was. And then this is like trial 20, when most of the time the new map was expressed, but sometimes the old map was still expressed.
Is it possible that since the animal starts to run in different places, and therefore you're going to get good data for the quote-unquote new place fields and bad data for the old place fields because it's not going there? Or
No, we get the place fields from the pre-probe. So we had the pre-probe. So, you know, we had this pre-probe session when the animal was still running, and that was the old map. And this was still present in the beginning. And then as the animal relearned that the food is somewhere else, then there was remapping, and then we got a new map, which was still there in the post-probe. So actually our place fields are complete.
I think it's not the question of the lookup. Mm-hmm. It's during task, I think, partly his question. But during the task, animal with time will simply not go to the older locations.
Yeah. But it's still, so what I mean is that it's...
But you get fewer spikes because they're not going there, so you go, it's not... It doesn't seem consistent with it somehow. I mean, you just might get noisier.
Well, I mean, even then, so as I said, that by chance, 10% of the cells would have a place field at a goal location, even in the old map. I think it's, if you have 100 cells, you would still at least 10 firing at, even with the old map at a goal location. So you would be able to identify that. So in any case, so we got this fluctuation of the map during learning. And then initially, there was a flickering of the old and the new maps. And then later in the sessions, the new maps dominated. But then we had another surprising finding. And this is when interneurons come into the picture, that we've noticed that some of our interneurons actually follow these fluctuations. So some of our inhibitory interneurons increased their firing when the new maps were present, and then they suppressed their firing when the old maps were there. But we got the opposite as well. So some interneurons actually suppressed their firing when the new maps were there, and then they fired stronger when the old maps were there.
This means that interneurons would have a place like...
Is this the next figure? So I'm showing that this one is not related to, well, it's a couple of figures back. They normally have, but this effect is independent of space. So what I argue with all this, that I have interneurons that form an association with entire maps. So if one map is expressed, then this interneuron will either increase or decrease its firing, whereas if there's another map, then it does not care. So this interneuron knows the entire map, not only a place. Okay, so because of time, so this is just about the past, that there has been some reports that interneurons increase their firing rate or decrease their firing rate in a novel environment, but this was always an utter confusion, and like, for example, we could never really confirm these results, and maybe now with these findings we could have a better explanation of this. So as essentially, this is the quantification what I said, that so this is the, for example, these are cells that increase their firing rate with the new maps. So this is the map expression score. So the positive is the new map, the negative is the old map, and you can see that these cells show the positive correlation. So they had a higher firing rate when the new map was expressed than when the old map was present. Whereas these are the negatively correlated cells. So in this case, these interneurons had a lower firing rate with the new maps than with the old maps. These two groups was about 70%, and then the remaining 30% did not care. So these were the cells that did not care about maps. And these are just expression of the interneuron firing rate, some of the cells. So this one, this interneuron indeed increased their firing with the new maps, and you can see it in their firing rate as well. And then this interneuron suppressed its firing rate with the new maps, and you can see it overall in its firing rate. And then this is a interneuron that did not care.
Is that open there?
Yes. And see it on.
So you're computing the interneuron firing rate in each feeder cycle?
Yes. In this figure, yes. Yeah, instantaneous firing rate.
And
mm-hmm.
this phase processing interneurons, or they're like just either locked interneurons?
I know that we have reports in the literature about phase processing interneurons, but it's a complicated thing.
It's a complete what?
It's a complicated thing. So indeed, there has been Maurer and McNaughton had a report showing that sometimes interneurons show multiple phase processing field. But yeah.
Several people have done Nates, McNaughton, three labs have shown this phase processing interneurons, right?
Yeah, but it's always it's a kind of a messy picture because the interneurons does not have a clear field, so you have it's like a little bit like you have to see it in the pictures. And this is just an explanation that this was independent of place. So we just compare this. So we measure this rate versus map expression correlations at different locations. For example, at goal locations or in different segments, and we always got a similar correlation. So this was all independent of space, or it was also independent of speed. So a cell that was positively associated was positively associated at low speed, high speed, and independent of location. So this was not a place-related observation. And then I guess this is just the consequence that that I also showed there, because some cells increase their firing with the new maps. And new maps tend to express more towards the end of learning, then as a consequence, some interneurons increase their firing rate during the course of learning, whereas if an interneuron suppress their firing with the new maps, then this will suppress their firing rate with learning, and some did not change. And again, this was an effect that we saw in the normal conditions, whereas if you take the the acute condition when there was no remapping, then we also, within 10 years, we did not see any firing rate.
Did you correlate the interneuron firing rate with the principal cell firing rate? Did they basically go up in proportion to one another?
Yeah, no, this we did not do. Well, so actually with the rest of the talk will be about cross correlations, but it's about monosynaptic connections.
During novel learning, you usually get
increased firing rate.
So you would expect the interneurons to also fire more.
Yeah, that's true, but of course some of them will suppress their firing. But actually, this is the rest of the talk is along your line. So the next thing is we try to find an explanation for these findings. And so one explanation could be that this is coming from the drive of pyramidal cells. So in the hippocampus, pyramidal interneuron connections are special because normally these connections are quite strong. So you can even identify monosynaptically connected cell pairs in cross-correlation analysis. So normally what you see, and in the CA1 region, you can only see this between pyramidal cells and interneurons, because pyramidal cells, for example, are not connected at all, and then in the cell pairs, you wouldn't see this. So normally what you see that in the cross-correlation analysis, there's a very sharp peak, either at 1 or at 2 milliseconds. So essentially what happens that whenever a pyramidal cell fires an action potential, then this will trigger the postsynaptic interneuron to fire also an action potential within 1 or 2 milliseconds, within a 1 or 2 millisecond delay. And this connection can be quite strong. On average, it's about 10 to 20%, so 10 or 20% of the time when the pyramidal cell fires an action potential, then it's followed by an interneuron action potential.
You know if these are fast spiking interneurons?
Yes, but it's a crude definition. It's a pyramidal layer interneurons, and these are high firing rate interneurons.
Probably a basket cell or something.
Or bistratified. So I would not say they are perisomatic. So in the pyramidal layer, we have basket cells, oxoaxonic cells, or bistratified cells. And unfortunately, we cannot really differentiate them. For example, they are all PARP1 immunopositive.
PV.
PV, but it does not help you because they target either the dendrites or the soma. And so actually some of these pairs can be quite strong, for example, 50%. So it means that 50% of the time the pyramidal cells can recruit the firing of the interneuron. So this is the baseline thing, and then we had similar cross correlations in our data set as well. And then essentially we inferred the connection strength from the cross correlation peak. Of course, we have to take into account the firing rate changes of the interneurons and the pyramidal cells during learning. So essentially what we always did that we subtracted the baseline probability, what we had in the cross correlations that gives you the chance probability that these cells fire action potentials together. Of course, there's another way to do this, and this was suggested by one of the reviewers that we did, that you can do a classical covariance-based method, which is independent of firing rate. But in any case, so you can, there are different ways to do it, and it leads you to a different result. So essentially what we saw that often these cross-correlation peaks changed. And the surprising thing was that these peaks always changed during learning, but not after or before. So we did a lot of quantifications. So this is just showing the change of these cross correlation peaks during the course of learning, and then it shows that that the last one, so the end of the learning, it's always the cross correlation peak at the end of the learning. It's always similar to the what happens after, like in the post-probe after, and it's dissimilar in the end of the learning what was before. So there was a change. And so this is cross correlations that decrease their firing, and this is cross correlations that increase their firing. And then this shows that that the sleep firing, the cross correlations during sleep, were also related to the waking firing. So essentially, always what happened that there was a change in the cross correlations during learning, but not before or after. And actually, I have additional controls here, so I have to remember them all. But so this one shows that you always see these changes at the monosynaptic delay at 1 or 2 milliseconds. However, you did not see this change at if you looked at another bin, for example, at 5 milliseconds, or if you take those interneurons that did not change their firing, the unrelated interneurons, you also did not change. You did not see a change in this cross correlation peaks if you take took cross correlations that did not show this monosynaptic peak. Well, I think so. We have several controls here. If you want to criticize me, I can go on with this. And then there was another interesting observation that. That normally there was a correlation between cross correlation peak and also delay. So essentially, if there was an increase in the cross correlations, then there was a shortening of the delay. So the spike transmission delay was shorter when there was an increase of the peak, whereas if there was a delay, then the transmission. So if there was a decrease in the cross correlation peak, then the transmission delay was longer. So there was a negative correlation of these two, which is again it shows that these two hand in hand. And then comes finally the interesting thing. So can we explain with this cross correlation changes the firing rate associations of cells? So for this, we actually also identified pyramidal cells that were selectively firing with the new maps or with the old maps. And we did like a similar analysis. So this is an interneuron pyramidal cell that fires with the new map. So you can see that this has a strong firing when the map expression is relating to the new maps, but it doesn't fire at all or very weakly when the MAC expression is the old map. So if we took cell pairs that were pyramidal cells that fired with the new maps, and then we took interneurons that increased their firing with the new maps, then on average we always got an increase in this monosynaptic cross correlation. However, if we took an interneuron that was suppressed its firing with the new maps, and it was a pyramidal cell that increased its firing with the new map, then there was a decrease in the firing. So it, as expected, but we also had pyramidal cells that preferentially fired with the old maps and not with the new maps, and then in this case we got the opposite. So if we had an interneuron that increased its firing with the new maps and the pyramidal cell suppressed, preferentially firing with the old map, then that was a suppression in the cross correlation peak, whereas in the remaining case there was an increase. So this all shows that actually this cross correlation changes could explain the firing behavior of the interneurons. And I think I skipped this because we are out of time. And conclusions, so I try to argue that place cells can help coding for spatial memory. And I also showed that direct reactivation can predict memory performance. And then about the second part, so basically I showed that during spatial learning, we saw a flickering of the maps, that both the old and the new maps could transiently be there and rapidly fluctuate. And then this also enabled us to relate the interneuron firing rates to the two different maps. And then we saw interneurons that either increased or suppressed their firing with the new maps. And then finally we show that we identify monocyclic cross correlations between pyramidal cells and interneurons, and then we show changes in this during spatial learning, and then this type of cross correlation changes went in a way that they can explain this firing association of interneurons. So there's two major things. One is that spatial learning seems to involve wide-ranging network changes that does not only involve pyramidal connection changes, but it also involves changes in interneuron circuits. And then finally, what we put forward, that interneurons may have a general role in map selection. So they may fire a lot with one map, but not with another, so they may have to determine which map is activated at a given time. And thanks for the attention.
Why would you not expect the interneuron firing rate to change just strictly as a result of the pyramid cells changing their firing rates? In other words, if just the pyramid cells alone are learning, wouldn't you, and the interneurons were not learning, so to speak, mm-hmm. Wouldn't you expect the interneuron firing rate to change anyway?
Yes, but as I said, so some of our interneurons actually suppress their firing rate during learning.
Yes.
Whereas pyramidal cells, overall, what we expect in overall conditions, that they increase their firing rate. Some dissociated their firing rate.
Yes.
And this one is probably related to this monosynaptic connection changes.
But all those tests were monosynaptic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You weren't really able to sample more than one. If you sampled more than one pyramid cell in the environment and see if the overall neighborhood was increasing or decreasing its firing rate. And in other words, it could be a neighborhood effect. Not necessarily.
Well, that's true that with the monosynaptic connections we sample, we bias for nearby pairs. That's definitely true. All I'm just that's neuron firing rates are driven by pyramidal activity, and overall, I think they are highly correlated, that if interneuron pyramidal activity goes up, then interneuron activity can go up. What I'm just arguing with, that we had cases that we had some interneurons that actually surprisingly suppressed their firing rate during learning, whereas overall other cells increased their firing rate. So to get to this point, overall probably induction of the monosynaptic connection strength. Mm-hmm. That's what we also demonstrated.
I need about the goal-oriented demapping. Mm-hmm. So you're saying learning these goals will cause global remapping of the entire map. I'm just wondering, do you have really a good place field has nothing to do with any of the goal location after the place field actually changed or global remap?
Yeah.
That's something that I'm just curious. It's really
we never really fully examined this. So I have to say that obviously, like, we cannot sample water. No, actually, in the post-probe, it would be.
Yeah. So.
But
how many potential was I there? And every day you kind of have three fire was and three new ones. How many potential?
So overall, these gold cells, it was about like 30% of the cells.
How many potential what size?
Oh, so we always had three out of, I think there's 170, roughly, reward size, yeah. No,
there should be empty space that allows you to see whether the people over there actually changed between the probe and the fire.
Along those lines, so if on one day new fields form at the goal locations according to that day, and then the next day you change them, do the cells that generated a new field at the goal location lose that field when the goal locations change, or is there are they permanently there now, or is a cell that forms a goal location in one goal on one day, does that cell now form a field at the new goal location, or does it? You know, talking about how persistent are these representations of the goal locations, and are the same cells likely to more than chance always encode the new goal location, or is it sort of random?
Yeah, so I think it's more of a random thing. We never really quantify this, but at least even if you look at the examples, some cells had a place field before. And then they moved it to have a place field somewhere else, whereas other cells did not fire at all, and they still had a place field location. So the reason I'm just arguing that it's not always a selected set of cells that remapped to goal locations, because some cells were silent in the pre-probe, indicating that the day before this cell wasn't a goal cell. Yeah, it from the place from the location.
Very good. So we will meet again at 11, but upstairs in this room, which is overlooking the Pacific, and then we'll discuss what the Olympics tell us and what anything else is. Thank you.